What these series of discussions or presentations are about, well, the whole theme is richness of my faith, but first we have to kind of talk about the richness of ourselves, what's inside of us, because if we're of poverty within, there isn't very much we can give out. So that's what the first presentation is tonight. And so I'm going to sort of dig around inside of ourselves and find out what's there. We're going to follow the presentation tonight with a very short get acquainted game. This get acquainted game is a psychological test which has always failed on college campuses among psychology students, but it works phenomenally well with normal people. So when we play this game, I think you'll discover you're going to meet a few new people you never met before. You're going to get acquainted with them. You're going to find out something about yourself you didn't know what was there. It's going to happen just because you're a human being. That follows tonight. That's the whole discussion, is just sort of getting acquainted. Because I don't know if you where you are, but I am so tired I can't even get nervous. But I'm going to try. I also cut out half of the talk tonight because I figured that would be better for you. We'll give it after 2 o'clock in the River Sauna. Tomorrow, I intend to give some kinds of presentations about different kinds of religious beliefs of other groups. So if you have any particular group you want to discuss of how we relate to them as Christians, like the Moonies, Hare Krishna, and so forth, you've got to let your leader in your group, because we'll be choosing those tonight, know, so they can get back to me. Otherwise, I have to fly by the seat of my pants, and I don't like to do that. And I'm hoping that someone will ask me to give the call of the minaret, because I used to room with a Syrian and a Lebanese roommates, and they used to get, I'll pass that story on. They used to call out the song of the minaret about 2 o'clock in the morning. I used to be really good at it after 3 years. Following that particular presentation is a time to kind of share the kinds of things we've been put on by different kinds of groups, Christian and otherwise, and what they've done to us as people, and whether we felt put down. I don't know if you've ever gone through SeaTac, you know, and one of those sweet young things comes out. Maybe she doesn't to you, but she comes out generally the way it is, a sweet young thing comes out to a male who's alone, and she says, "May I give you a flower?" And then she asks you for $5 for their Unification Church youth group, or tries to sell you their Bible, the Bhagavad Gita. I brought one tonight in case you have never bought one before. It's not tonight, it's in my room, I borrowed it. We'll bring it out tomorrow. We discuss some of the way they put us down. And then the last discussion tomorrow night is how we can actually talk to these people and express our love and our Christianity to them as human beings, and if they turn us out or turn us down or turn us off, they're doing that to us. But I don't know about you, but every time a Jehovah's Witness knocks on my front door, I lose my cool. I have never once kept it. I've always felt mad. And so I'm trying to deal with that. The worst way I've ever been put down with a group of people has always been Christians. No Buddhist has ever put me down brutally, or Hare Krishna, or Jehovah's Witness. It's been Christians. It's kind of sad, but that happens that way. So we want to deal with some of these things, of how we can relate to people who put us down as people. So I'm beginning tonight sort of giving you the outline of the presentations and the way some of the discussion groups go. Your discussion group's leaders are not prepared to lead you because they're not supposed to provide you with the answers. They're only supposed to help us all talk when we want to, and we don't have to talk if we don't. It sort of guide the conversations. You see, we have two problems, most of us. We don't really feel very good about ourselves. We've been put down too often by other people, and more brutally, by ourselves. It's just like when you do something, whether you play guitar or the piano or you sing or you preach or you give a talk or whatever it is, and there's 40 people in the room, and 39 come up to you and they say, "That was really neat." You know, one right after the other, and after a while you get to believing it. And then the 40th one comes along and says, "That stinks." Which one do you remember? It stinks. Who do you see walking down the street 4 times the next week? It stinks. You know what they look like. You know the color of their eyeballs and the dirt under their fingernails and etc. and how green their teeth are. But the people who said, "That was neat," We don't remember who they are or what they look like. We forget them. When we get put down, we remember all those things. We sort of put it inside. We have sort of like a gunny sack we're trailing behind us, and we dump all the put downs in the sack. And the things which are really nice about us, often we don't collect. It sort of passes off, like it's not being humble to accept thanks or praise. I don't know about you, but it's taken me 43 years for anybody to say, gee, that was neat, Roger, and for Roger to begin to believe it, or at least act like a human being. Usually I try to put myself down or make a big excuse or smile or make a face or something. I haven't learned yet to even take praise. But when somebody comes along and really attacks me, Roger's got his guard up. He can handle that. I've got lots of practice. But somebody puts their arms around me and says, Roger, that was great. Roger doesn't know what to do. It's really difficult. You know, most of us also don't know much about our Bible and our faith and our relationship with each other as Christians or Lutherans. I just want you to know you don't have to. You don't have to know all the answers. If you get attacked by a group of Christians, attacked, you know, sort of put down by people who know all the questions and all the answers, I've got news for you. I've had people get so mad at me in my class that I teach at University of Idaho. By the way, I'm also a campus pastor at University of Idaho. There's one person, two people over there, they're cheering. And Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston, Idaho. But I teach in the School of Religion, University of Idaho, and people come into my class and they get so furious with me. And one student came in this last semester, about halfway through, and he was so mad, and he said, "You are tearing apart everything I believe." I kept shaking my head up and down. And finally, he sort of cooled down for a while, and we began talking. And toward the end of the semester, we began relating with each other as human beings, which was new for him and unusual for me. And things really went beautiful. The goal for tonight is to kind of emerge more as a loving, caring person, feeling pretty good about ourselves, and getting to know ourselves, getting to know people like those whom we hugged, knowing that they're important, and so are we. Because, you know, love is a learned phenomena. We aren't given it in our gene patterns. It just doesn't happen because mom and dad said, you should love each other, brother and sister. Love, we learn. And we learn all kinds of different love. Neurotic love, neat love, lousy love, all sorts of love. Paul Sorokin, in his book, The Ways and Powers of Love, has a chapter titled, What a Loving Person Is. The first thing he says is a loving person loves himself. And a few years ago, if someone would tell you you should love yourself, everyone would say, man, that person's encouraging you to go on an ego trip. You don't love yourself. You don't pat yourself on the back. You sort of be humble and say, oh, and that can't be true. I should love my neighbor better than myself. You're not supposed to love yourself. We discovered the hard way that you can't love others unless you really do love yourself. You might play games with them, but you don't really love them. It's not like while you're brushing your teeth in the morning, you look in the mirror and you say, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the loveliest person of all? And the mirror says, you lovely old thing, you. It's not that kind of thing. It's not where you sort of look at yourself with self-adoration and say, oh boy, it's me, all right, how lovely I am. When you get a little older, you keep looking in the mirror and you say, yep. There are three ingredients we want to discover about ourselves. First is hope. What would you like to do with your life for other people? You ever dreamed what you want to have happen in your life 5 years from now? Picture it. 5 years from now. What do you want to have happened in your life? It's difficult for us to even think that far ahead. We can't even think till June the 1st, especially if we have term papers due. Yeah. 5 years. And love, that feeling, whatever it is, whether it's neurotic or bigoted, really great or super cool, but whatever we have, love. And sharing, giving away because we haven't lost a thing. A loving person is one who loves themselves and will give that love away to others. But the ugly fact is, we don't often feel or think we are very much. And outside, we keep a nice face for everybody to look at, and we sort of smile, sometimes painfully, but you know, if you keep your lips looking pointed up, everyone thinks it's a smile. And deep down inside, we're probably crying. We play games with each other. We try to put people off. We get involved in game playing. And deep down inside, we feel kind of hollow and small and worthless. We turn in upon ourselves first. It's we who get the twitches and the nerves, and we hate ourselves first. If you've never read Walden by Thoreau, read it sometime, and you'll find the line, "O God, to have reached the point of death, only to find that I've never lived at all. I've never loved anyone nor done anything for anyone else." There's a man in California by the name of R.B. Langer. At least he wrote it when he was in California. Took a group of children whom everyone else said was insane. Children that schools and society had cast out because they were unteachable, untrainable. Some of them even sat in a catatonic stance. I don't know if you know what catatonic means. It's what people usually look like after they've been listening to me for an hour. Eyeballs focused on the end of their nose and sort of glazed a little bit. But he took these children and he put them in his thing called Institutes for Hopeless Children. He treated them just like they were normal, healthy, happy children. And you know, miracle of miracles, they were. They were all brilliant children. But put down by everything around them, and primarily by their own loved ones and the people in contact with them. So they retreated inside of their own shells to keep from being hurt. And they never went out. But in some way, with the kinds of people he had around treating them lovingly, they came out of their shells like hermit crabs. If you've never seen a hermit crab on the beach, it sort of runs along and drags its shell with them. And that's the way they've been. Who is sick? The children who won't adjust to a society which puts them down, or a society that demands that we adjust to its sickness? What is pornography? Perhaps some of you saw 60 Minutes the other night. I didn't. My oldest daughter, who's not here with us tonight, did see it. And she talked about it all during dinner, and I almost lost it. 2 hours later, we were eating dessert, and she brought the subject up again. I still ate my dessert and held it down. But it must have been very dynamic for her. What is pornography? It's the right to sell something because people want to buy it. It degrades males and females as not persons but things. It degrades God's greatest gift of nonverbal communication called intercourse into something else. For the man who said on the program, "Well, you know, we should be able to sell it because people want to buy it," I want to say, "You know, I want to hire a hit man. The poor man's out of work. I'll provide him with a job, and that's you. If you don't mind, he wants to sell, I want to buy. So you're the victim? Tough." You know, that's a kind of his philosophy too. He shouldn't mind. R.B. Langer in his article concluded, "We think much less than we know. We know much less than we love. We love much less than there is. Therefore, we are much less than we really are." In a society that says, "Look, man, I don't have time for you. I am too busy. The only thing you have is you. The only real, wonderful, worthwhile things around you are people, not machines." And any idiot who wants to go out and buy like I did. I remember I bought a racing Corvette way back in the dark ages when I was really dumb. Because I thought it would attract women. It did. And when I finally fell in love, the woman I fell in love with didn't like my racing Corvette, and I bought a Volkswagen Bug. It attracted the wrong kind of women, but at least the last one I had attracted was attracted to the driver and not the damn car. But you read the ads on TV, and if you don't have anything within your side of you worthwhile, just getting behind our wheel and you'll make it. How sick can we be to believe that stuff? But we're all vulnerable. Secondly, a loving individual frees herself, hope you like that, ladies, or himself from labels and from the dictates of time. You know, I had a class lecture this past semester. It was unbelievable. I had eyeball contact with every cotton-picking person in that class. Usually you don't have eyeball contact with your class Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 9 o'clock in the morning, especially on Monday mornings at 9 o'clock. And I had eyeball contact with everybody in that class, and the whole lecture for 50 solid minutes, I don't remember looking at my lecture notes. I don't remember what I said. I can't tell you. I had to go back and say that almost the same thing the next time around because I didn't use one paragraph of it. But I was really turned on, and I was going through the whole thing, and whatever was inside was poured out, and everybody was there, and nobody was taking notes. They didn't have to. They were listening. You take notes in college when you don't want to listen. Nobody was taking notes. They were all looking at me, eyeball to eyeball, and it was beautiful. And the bell rang, and I stopped, and nobody left. Usually when the bell rings, by the time I would even, on the inhale, they're out of the class and gone. Because, you know, you got to get across the campus and go. Nobody left. And I looked around, I said, what do I do now? And they said, are you finished? And I said, no. And they said, finish. And so I took 5 more minutes and I finished, and most of the people were late and they didn't give a... I didn't say it. And going back that day, it was a fantastic day because I went back outside and people were standing around talking and they didn't go anyplace, and a couple of people came up and talked, and we did for a while, and I finally went back down to where my office is, and there's a sundial on the side of a building, and a woman came by with a whole bunch of kindergartners. And one of the little kids said, teacher, what's that? And she says, that's a sundial. And they're on their way by, you know, there's a long line of kids, and there's one on one end and one on the other end to make sure that no one gets too far in front or too far behind, and they sort of go in a line. And the little boy said, can we watch it? And the teacher said, there's nothing to watch except it moves when she got involved in it, and all the kids crowd around. So she explained the whole sundial. And one of the little kids said, what time is it? And she said, it's 10:30. And he says, what happens at that next mark? And she says, then it's 10:35. He says, can we watch it? And so the whole class sat down on the cold sidewalk. And believe me, it was cold because I sat down with them and watched them. And they watched the sundial for 5 minutes, quietly, not a word out of them, as they watched the sun creep around. And finally it reached the notch. They didn't know what notch it was, but there was a notch, and they watched it hit the notch, and it was there. And they sort of went, and they got up, and they walked away. Keeper on one end, the keeper on the other end, the keepees in the middle, but believe it or not, it was changed that day, because the keepees was on both ends, the keepers were in the middle. The kids really knew where it was, and they enjoyed it. And the teacher knew where it was too, and she enjoyed them, and she took the time. You know, at Holden, we help them for meals around here, and there's quiet time and all that kind of stuff. And we sort of go by their meals and their times and things, because after all, they're not our servants. And I hope you realize that most of these people are up here as volunteers. They don't get paid for cleaning up our junk. They're volunteers. So every time you throw your trash over your shoulder or something like that, then somebody's got to pick it up. It's a dime. I thought it was a penny. I won't throw that out. I'll pick that up after a while. But somebody's got to pick it up. It should be us, not them. They're not our slaves or servants. They're just people. That's why they invited us back this year. Because the ALC youth don't get invited up here. Did you know that? The LCA youth did last year on probation. You heard, we were on probation. We came through and they couldn't believe how neat we were. And that's why we're back again this year. So if we want to do it again next year, whatever we want, it's up to us. We make our own choice. Labels for people. Hey, who has that neat t-shirt which says something on the bottom? Is that t-shirt present? Who's got that t-shirt? I saw it at dinner time tonight. You mean it's a Holden Village person? Hey, does somebody in our group have this one that says WAP on the bottom? Now, where is that t-shirt? Gee, I want to see that t-shirt. I want to look for it all the time. Anyway, you know, there's labels. WASP, honky, dago, WAP, spick, nigger, Christian, Pentecostal, Lutheran, labels. Are you Christian? Well, I was baptized as an infant in the Lutheran church. But now that I've become a Christian, what have I done? Passed a test? Been inoculated? Vaccinated? What have I done? Have I had a super experience so now I know that I've become Christian? You know what becoming Christian means? It means you're a follower of Christ. Whether you can waddle, crawl, walk, or leap, you're a follower of Christ. Now how well you waddle is up to you. You know what being a Christian is? You know, I usually choose a biblical text, some more infamous than others. I couldn't find it tonight, so I turned to my wife, and she knew. It was in the 25th chapter of Matthew, and tonight we're going to read it in the proper version because I'm sure Matthew messed up Jesus' parable. We have goats at our house, and he always puts the goats in the left hand and the sheep on the right. Goats are neat creatures. They're like pets. Sheep stink. The correct version should read, all the nations will be assembled before him, and he will separate men from one another as a shepherd separates the goats from the sheep. He will place the goats on his right hand and the sheep on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you whom my father has blessed, take your heritage. The kingdom is prepared for you since the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you made me welcome. Naked and you clothed me. Sick and you visited me. In prison and you came to see me. Then the virtuous will say to him in reply, Lord, when did we see you hungry or feed you or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and make you welcome, naked and clothe you, or sick or in prison and came to see you? The king will answer, I tell you solemnly, in so much as you did this to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. Next he will say to those in his left hand, get away from me, with your curse upon you, to the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you never gave me food. I was thirsty and you never gave me anything to drink. I was a stranger and you never made me welcome, naked and you never clothed me, sick and in prison you never visited me. Then it will be their turn to ask, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, a stranger or naked or sick or in prison, and did not come for your help? And he will answer, I tell you solemnly, insomuch as you neglected to do this to one of the least of these, you neglected to do it to me. What is a Christian? Not one who says, aha, you must not be a Christian. You don't sound like me and you weren't baptized me. You must be on the left hand because I know I'm on the right. A Christian is one who does not become a judge over another human being because there's only one judge in the world and that is God. And so when a person comes up and asks you, are you Christian? Don't say, I'm Lutheran. If they say, are you Christian? You say, yes. They say, where do you go to church? You should say, I express my Christianity in the Lutheran church. And that should end the conversation. If it doesn't, you should have an interesting one following. Nowadays, too many people are quite sure that they're following Jesus Christ and nobody else is. It's like putting a legal trip on us, you and I. So don't let it happen to you. You know that song, and they'll know we are Christians by our, what is it? Yeah. They'll know we are Christians by our saving experience, by our speaking in tongues, by our born again as it is, itis, by our 3 hours of prayer a day, by our 6 Bible studies a week, by our 20-minute sermons, or by our love. The hypocrisy of labels does not contain me, nor does it contain you. Thirdly, a loving individual abhors waste, especially human being waste. Man, can you imagine 5,000 hours of TV is what a five-year-old has had in their craw by the time they hit kindergarten? 5,000 hours of TV. Can you imagine having to sit through right now, beginning right now, 5,000 hours of Saturday morning cartoons? And those really neat commercials. Think what it's like. You know, I watched a little bit of TV this last week, not to watch the programs more, but watch the commercials, because I got off watching TV for a little while. And as he puts his hand gently on her shoulder, and he says, "My, your shoulders are smooth." And she says, "That's because of Caress." He's just about to plant a kiss on her neck, and she turns and says, "Have you got the signal?" Am I glad that certs click click is off the TV? I haven't seen it in a long time. If he kissed you once, will he kiss you again? Be certain with certs. Be certain if there's something worth kissing. Well, there's more of this stuff. You know, it's just one after another. There's some beautiful things on TV, if you believe that stuff. But of course, they're written for a person in the sixth grade. I have a sixth grader here. I hope I'm not insulting her. Or, "Dear Emily Post, what flowers should a bride wear at her wedding?" Emily says, "Radishes, honey." Emily Post says, "Ladies shouldn't laugh. They should titter demurely." Whatever that means. Practically all of our society ads say, "Men don't cry, especially hairy-chested men." Have you ever seen a cigarette ad or a beer ad that has a guy with, well, I don't even do it since I've been, should have been jogging around more than I have. You ever seen a cigarette or a beer ad with a guy sort of really turns you on, you know, on the belly that sticks clear out to here, and he says, "You only go around once in the life." Or somebody that says, "Down in our ranch, we chew Copenhagen." And at Pullman High School in Pullman, Washington, the ninth graders spit off the balcony to the people even a inch below. It's really neat. And if you don't believe me, ask my daughter who isn't here. She's been hit twice and a sandwich once. Men don't cry. Men are suave, cool, sophisticated. Nothing bothers them. They just get ulcers, die when they're 45. Of course, that's not the only cause of ulcers. I don't know if you feel very good about yourself, but if you fall for the kind of crap that's on TV, on the ads, of what you can smear on you or do with yourself to make you better, if you're foolish enough to buy it, be my guest. Somebody has to provide for those programs. But can you imagine stopping 1,000 housewives in downtown Seattle and you ask them, "Women, what is your greatest fear in life?" And together in one loud voice, they say together, "Ring around the collar." Just think, girls, if you get married and have a family, what you have waiting for you to look forward to, fighting ring around the collar and other important things like that, and all those germs around the kitchen sink and in the toilet and all those places. Oh, wow. Doesn't that really turn you on? And I know some young women who've ran away from home to get married, to get away from housework. Then they come in for counseling, and I cry. I cried 6 times in the past month with young couples who were breaking up. And I cried for a friend who had performed a marriage, and the young woman committed suicide 3 months after her wedding day. And he says, "Roger, what the hell went wrong?" And we talked, and I don't know what went wrong. But I had to put my arm around him and hug him because, you see, he's in the same business I am, and he wanted to make them feel good about each other, to make sure and talk about all the facets of life that might come up. And she killed herself. I thought, my God, what a waste. My batting average isn't so good. I have 2 people who've decided they really do love each other, and in spite of their differences and hating each other's guts, they're going to try to stick it out and grow in their love. And 2 that said to hell with it. And 2 others right now are flipping their coin, heads or tails. And I probably will know when I get home. My batting average isn't so good. I have 2 people who've decided they really do love each other, and in spite of their differences and hating each other's guts, they're going to try to stick it out and grow in their love. And 2 that said to hell with it. And 2 others right now are flipping their coin, heads or tails. And I probably will know when I get home. Men don't cry. They just keep everything inside and don't share it with anyone, because after all, that's being manly. And women are supposed to nag. After all, that's the only way to get a man to do anything. Every once in a while, I use 2 of my most favorite literary quotes, because I only know 3. Beautiful scene from The Man from La Mancha, Don Quixote. When I was in high school, a few years ago, Don Quixote was the kind of person, you know, that was everybody's fool. Whenever you wanted to talk about a fool, it was Don Quixote and tilting with windmills. But perhaps you saw the Man from La Mancha. You saw the foolish old man tilting at windmills. Every time he would approach one on his horse that barely could walk, and a shield in his, is it a lance? Yeah, it's not a spear, it's a lance. And he charges the windmill, and he gets one, and pretty soon the next one comes around and knocks him off his horse and his whoopee-doopee, and he picks himself back up with his servant, or helps his servant, helps him get back up, and he gets back on, and he charges the next windmill. But who's really the foolish one? Because after all, Don Quixote is happy with what he's doing and enjoying it and having a lot of fun tilting windmills. And everybody else watching him go by just shakes their head and they say, "Foolish old man," as they trudge on through a very unhappy life. In the final scene, it's kind of bad for a while. Then it makes you cry if you're cryable, because there's a staircase, there's a light at the top of it. The light gets brighter and brighter, and only Don Quixote seems to see it. And there he is on his deathbed, and he gets up, he picks up his lance, and he starts climbing up the stairs. And the orchestra breaks out into the words of, "I dream the impossible dream." Many men would like to cry, but they don't dare, because men don't cry. If a tear comes down your eye at that or any other movie, you sort of make sure that no one sees you as you go to... I come out of movies nowadays and I'm not afraid to cry, and I enjoy it, because I do think it's being human. Life is a present wonder, so open your eyes and look and see what's around you. It's constantly changing. All those dogwood trees that were gorgeous last year, they're in bloom again, and we go back down the hill, there'll be different ones. I like to stop the damn bus and get off and look at the dogwood trees. "Is there a driver here? I will ride your bus." I don't care if it breaks down. Let it break down going downhill. We'll push. I'd just love to see a dogwood tree up close. I've never seen one in my whole life. Maybe I'll hitchhike going down. But there's a wonderful rhythm in you as a human being. And it meets the rhythm of God's creation on the outside, and you can dance. And you don't need music, because it's inside. The joy of yesterday is gone. It made us what we are today. And tomorrow, that's why we're alive. Tomorrow is what life is all about. Live each moment right now, because you know Holden Village is just a moment in your lives. A quick fleeting moment, and you enjoy it, and you say, boy, I wish I could stay up here my whole life. And then I've got to go back to Pullman, and you have to go back to Yakima or Missoula or Seattle, wherever you come from. And you got to go home. It's your turn to the dishes. Clean your room, which you probably swept under the, kicked everything underneath the bed before you came. You go back to life as humdrum and the usual people you always see, and you think, oh, yuck. Why can't it be like it is in Holden Village? And that's because you are blind. You can't even see the beauty around you. Be human. Accept what is you and accept other people as they are. They can't be any different. Why expect more than they can possibly be? So love them for what they are. Don't hate them for what they are not. They can never be that. They can never change that. So if you hate people around you for the rest of your life for what they're not, you are, well, I won't go into the rest of that. Fourthly, a loving person sees the continuous wonder of life. We forget the beauty of the world around us, the beauty on the inside of the eyeballs and the beauty on the outside of it. We worry about a lot about the tomorrows or the paper that's due on Monday. And guess who Miguel is going to be typing in the wee hours? Don't wear out his fingers, please, while he's up here, because he's got to type two papers as soon as he gets home because they're due Monday morning. We all feel for you, but nobody's going to help you. I've got a whole drawer full of papers over my office. A's, B's, C's, D's, and F's. You can take your pick, any one of them. They're free for the taking. And will there be life on this planet after 1984? Are we going to run out of fuel, or what is it? We need to enjoy more the miracle of being alive. You know, there's so many books that tell us how to choose goals in life as if goals are the most important thing. There's a goal, like you're a jackass, and there's a carrot hanging out in front of you, so follow the carrot, friend. That's your goal. Run, run, run. Get there. If you go fast enough, the carrot gets swingy enough, you might even get a bite. But really counts is the journey to get there. Too many people reach 50 and suddenly discover they've reached a goal like financial independence, only to discover that they really have not enjoyed living and they don't like life. You know, children are always asking fantastic questions. Like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And it's profound. Just a few years ago when I was a parish pastor in Santa Fe, New Mexico, one of the children came out after a worship service, and they were about this high, and they used to grab me by the robe, you know, and look up, and he said, Pastor, what do you want to be when you grow up? Now, I was 38 years old at the time. What a profound question. What do I want to be when I grow up? Because he recognized I hadn't grown up yet. I thought that was neat. And I thought, what do I want to be? A fireman? A cowboy? But really want to get rich. I'll own a massage parlor in Spokane. Just recently, I came out of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Moscow, Idaho, recently, a couple of years ago. And the pastor, it was in between pastors, and so I preached for a while, and their pastor used to always wear the black robe, and once in a while, the white surplice. That's that white thing we used to wear. I used to explain to people it's not surplus, it's surplice. Like lice, L-I-C-E on the end with the S-U-R in the front. Now I get to wear my white karate cape, and they all know. The little kid came out afterwards, and he looked at me, and he says, Mama, is that God? And she said, No, dear, it's only the pastor. What do I want to grow? What do I want to be when I grow up? I want to be human. That's what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be more human tomorrow than I'm what I am today. There's so much of myself that's dehumanizing. I've only recently discovered it. I'm 43 going on 44. Some of us are a little slower than others. I don't like the dehumanization within myself, and I don't want it. You better watch out, because I'm trying to change it and I'm not the same person some of you saw last year, even though it looks like the same person. I'm changing. I'm a different husband, different father, a different lover than I was last year. I feel better. At least I'm not worse. Life is a process, step by step. You and I are going to have something just as wonderful as Holden Village when we get home, if we'll open our eyes and love what we have. Whether it's a lawn full of dandelions. Ever gotten down and looked at a dandelion? No, you just spray them or dig them out or cuss them or say, yeah. Could you imagine what would happen in your neighborhood if you decided that you wanted to grow dandelions as a hobby? You would have a yard for the most beautiful flowers all the time, and you wouldn't have to dig out a thing or plant a root or fertilizer. They'd be there. Beautiful yellow golden flowers all year long. You wouldn't have to talk to your neighbors either. When you go home, don't miss it. The faces of your own family, and some of you may hate their guts. The faces of friends, they may not be much, but they are, and they care about you. They may do freaky things, but they still are. And don't miss touching and crying and holding and hugging and making a snowman in winter. You know, I went by the whole blessed winter this past time and didn't make a snowman. What a fool I was. Whole winter? Did I say summer? Whole winter? Snowman. Oh, yes, there was snow. I saw it. Oh, yes. There was snow. It snows in Pullman. Doesn't it snow in the rest of the world? Well, that's because we have the Three Forks rivers that come through Pullman, and our water is so good you can walk on it. Don't miss saying I love you to someone. Even your mom and dad, they may faint, but try it. Don't miss saying I love you to a brother and a sister, even though you may not think they're so neat, but you can try loving them. There's a poem written in 1970 and was titled, But You Didn't. You loaned me your car and I dented the fender. You could have scolded me, but you didn't. You invited me to your party, and I came in my old blue jeans. You could have gotten really mad at me, but you didn't. You took me to the beach, and we built sandcastles, and we ran in the surf and picked up seashells. Later, you wanted to kiss me, and I teased you, and I said, later, later, and you didn't. I thought we'd have plenty of time when you came home from Vietnam, and you didn't. This was written by Anonymous. Anonymous writes a hell of a lot of good stuff, by the way. Fifthly, a loving person understands the needs of other people because they need those same things themselves. What do I need? So do they. Leo Biscaglia is a USC psych prof. He tells about a group of teachers who've thrown out the Harvard standardized IQ test. This was done in 1918 and has been updated, at least the language has, but not the pictures often, year after year. We all know that anything from Harvard is good. Anyway, they threw Harvard out. Instead, they chose at random in their classes five students to decide to help them, especially during that rest of the semester, half a semester. Five people at random. And one teacher says she picked four goodies and George. George couldn't spurt out of a cannon. But at the end of the semester, the four and George had spurted. Another teacher in high school divided her class into three sections. For 6 weeks, she graded their test papers differently. To the first group, she graded only the paper with a letter grade, A, B, C, D, F. Nobody changed during those 6 weeks. To the second group, she graded their paper and gave the grade plus one word like nice, cool, lousy, so forth. They didn't change very much. To the third group, she wrote a whole letter on them. And on each paper, everybody changed. 18 wrong, 32 right. Which turns you on? Well, I decided I would do this in my own class because I had kind of a losing class when I began this semester. I ended up giving 19 A's, 8 B's, 3 C's. Everybody else who was getting C's, D's, and F's had dropped the class by mid-semester. But I was really teased because I gave 19 A's, but every one of those A people deserved it. And I wrote letters on the first exam they took. And on one boy's exam, I said, "You write lousy, but you have a great potential. You use neat words. Come in and see me." He came in and we talked for a little while, and I said, "You're a freshman." He said, "Yes." And he said, "How can you tell?" "It's easy. Read the paper, you can tell." He was my poorest student. And I said, "What you really need to do," and it was only 3 weeks into the semester, I said, "is to take an English class or two extra during your college year." I didn't know how quickly he would react because, you know, it's a religion course and religious people are supposed to be neat and so forth and honest. And he went right down and he signed up for a class and he dropped one. He took an English class. And about mid-semester, I got a nasty call from another professor who said, "You told my student to drop my class." I didn't tell him to drop any class. I just told him to take an English class. He took the English class. He dropped the other class. But interestingly, he didn't drop mine. I wonder why. I wish you could have read his second test. It was lousy. But it wasn't as lousy as the first. And I sat down with him and we rewrote the whole blessed thing, item by item. I wish you could have read the third test. It was one of the best I've ever received. His girlfriend must have helped him with the spelling because he didn't mess up much there either. But it was beautiful. Lousy, but you have great potential. 18 wrong, 32 right. A loving person is one who understands the needs of others. And often we need to reach out and touch each other. "Don't touch me. Stay away from me." You ever stood in an elevator? You know, the elevator stops. You walk inside. You turn around. You face the front. You watch the lights go by. The next time, and you're in a big city that's outside of Pullman, because our elevators only go up 2 floors, you're in a big city. Have we got any 3-floor elevators? Oh, yeah, in the university we have 12 stories. But they always break down. You walk up and down. Anyway, you're in a big city, walk into a building with an elevator, walk in and face everybody. And if it's really crowded, give them a big smile and say, "What if it would break down? We get stuck in here." By the 3rd floor, it'd be completely empty. You'd have the whole elevator to yourself. You could ride anywhere you want and even push the hold button if you'd like. Emily Post says, "A lady extends her hands to a gentleman and gently squeezes his hands with the tips of her fingers." Psychologists call that a distancing phenomena. And I've got a 4-letter word for it. You know, we also need to look at each other. I know people who've fallen in love, and they're madly in love, and I give this terrible test to young lovers. You know, people come in, and she's 16, and he's 17, and they've got to get married, and I look at her, and I say, "What color is his eye, are his eyes?" And she couldn't tell me whether he has 2 or 3. And I tell him, "Describe her. What's she like?" And he can't tell me. He doesn't know what she looks like. Sometimes I get fooled and they can tell me, "Yes, or her eyes are brown." And I say, "Both of them?" If you can't tell what a person looks like, how do you know what they're like inside? How do you know? Sometimes we need to reach out and touch each other. Just to know that we're there. My second example, I gave it last year. I haven't read anything else. Little Emily in Philip Wilder's Our Town, it's her 12th birthday, remember? She's in heaven and she's going to go back to earth. And everybody else says, "Emily, don't go, don't go." But she decides to go anyway because she remembers her 12th birthday, the happiest day of her whole life. She finally comes down the stairs and she says, "Mama, here I am, your birthday girl." Mama's too busy baking a birthday cake to look at her. She says, "Good morning, Daddy. I'm your birthday girl." And Daddy's too busy reading to look at her. And she says, "Good morning, brother." But you know how brothers are and sisters when you're in your 12 years old style. We're hung up on ourselves. And she says, "Look at me. I've forgotten how lonely it is to be human." You know what our youth congresses, LCA and ALC, the different kinds of group we have about folk music and modern dance and how to do all sorts of neat new things and loneliness and so forth. The most highly attended group of all is loneliness. Teenagers, lonely. This is supposed to be the happiest time in your whole life. Lonely? You can't be lonely. You're happy. And people are saying, "My God, I hope this is not the happiest time in my life." We had Mother's Weekend over Mother's Day at Wazoo. And right after the worship service, I was out in the narthex. I don't stand and shake people's hands and wind their watches unless I have to. And I'm out wandering around. And I overheard a mother telling her daughter, "Oh dear, this is the most wonderful time in your whole life." And in the daughter's eyes was yuck. But how do you tell your mother that? And then following on a Tuesday, we had a discussion in a group, and it was on the book Passages, which I'll mention on tomorrow night. And one of the mothers said, "You know, in your 40s is better than being 30s. And a whole group of people looked up and listened to her. She had their attention. And she's in your 20s or better than your 30s. And by that time, she had everybody's attention. And she said, "In the 20s are better than your teens. So this is not the best time in your life. It gets better. And I'm looking forward to 50. Because on page 32 of her book, she says, "When you reach 50, you reach that marvelous age when your theme is," oh, I don't know if I should even say it, "no more bullshit." That's in print. It says an awful lot. When you're 50, you're not going to take any of this other stuff that people pass off, that you can spread something under your arm or brush your teeth or polish your hair or whatever it is, and it's going to make you extra neat. By that time, your teeth and hair have probably fallen out, and you're down to real life anyway. Most of us never mature. We only grow bigger. And the purpose of life is to matter and to count, to amount for something, to make some difference, that we've lived it all. So love wherever you are, because people are lovely and they need love desperately, and most of us are very lonely. No matter where you are, whether you're 15 or 50, you're only starting. There's a bookstore in the city of San Francisco called the City Lights. I have two poems from there. The first one has a rather long title, but catch it. "I am neither a sacrilege nor a privilege. I may not be competent nor excellent, but I am present." That's the whole title. Now listen to this. "My happiness is me, not you. Not only because you may be temporary, but because also you want me to be what I am not. I cannot be happy when I change merely to satisfy your selfishness, nor can I feel content to be criticized for not thinking your thoughts or for seeing like you. When you reject my beliefs, you reject me. You said that I was transparent and easily forgotten. But why then did you try to use my life to prove to yourself what you are?" Michelle was 20 years old when she wrote it. And 20 years old on a 1967 fog-swept beach to leave the world and to continue on her way. Printed by friends in 1969. We love you. We need you. We will remember. I know I cut out some pages, but I didn't cut out those. I've got my neatest quote of all in here. They're all in exact order as I count backwards, just like I'm blasting off. Oh, horrible, horrible. It must be packed in with my Bhagavad Gita. I really brought one. Well, since I ran out of notes, I better close. I'll continue with the rest of that which I forgot tomorrow if I brought it. What is a loving person? You are, if you want to be. Or you can be a hateful, despicable wretch. You have a choice. It's not in your gene pattern, or what your parents have done to you, or your peer group, or your friends, or your church, or anyone else in this world. You can love if you want to, and being religious for just a moment, because of John 3:16, for God so loved the world. So be yourself in this world. Be this yourself in a world that's trying to make you into something that you are not. Through every bit of advertising you see on TV, through all the coercion of your own peer group, whether you're 15 or 50, they want you to always go by their will, and that's going to be your biggest battle in the world. But also it's going to be your only survival. I made careful notes after last year's presentation. They must be with the rest of mine. And I asked several people, what was that neat reading I read last year that you all wanted copies of? And I was assured that none of you would remember. So what I want to do now is to have you close your eyes and hold the hand of persons each side of you. And if you're on the aisle, don't try to stretch. Just hold on one hand. Just close your eyes and hold hands for a minute. Because everything I've said in these minutes are summed up very quickly in this. The title of it is, Please Hear What I Am Not Saying. Don't be fooled by me. Don't be fooled by the face I wear, for I wear a mask. I wear 1,000 masks. Masks that I'm afraid to take off, and none of them are me. Pretending is an art that is second nature with me, but don't be fooled. For God's sake, don't be fooled. I give you the impression that I am secure, that all that is sunny and unruffled within me, and also without. That confidence is my name and coolness is my game, that the water is calm and I'm in command, that I need no one. But don't believe me, please. My surface may seem smooth, but my surface is my mask, my ever-varying and ever-concealing mask. Beneath lies no smugness, no complacence. Beneath dwells the real me in confusion, in fear, in aloneness, but I hide this. I don't want anybody to know it. I panic at the thought of my weakness and fear being exposed. That's why I frantically create a mask to hide behind, a nonchalant, sophisticated facade to help me pretend, to shield me from the glance that knows. But such a glance is precisely my salvation, my only salvation, and I know it. That is, if it's followed by acceptance, if it's followed by love, it's the only thing that can liberate me from myself, from my own self-built-up prison walls, from the barriers that I have so painstakingly built. It's the only thing that will assure me of what I can't assure myself, that I am really worth something. But I don't tell you this. I don't dare. I'm afraid to. I'm afraid your glance will not be followed by acceptance and love. I'm afraid you'll love me less, that you'll laugh, and your laugh will kill me. I'm afraid that deep down I'm nothing, that I'm just no good, and that you'll see this and reject me. So I play my game, my desperate pretending game, with a facade of assurance without and a trembling child within. And so begins the parade of masks, the glittering but empty parade of masks. And my life becomes a false front. I idly chatter to you in the suave tones of surface talk. I tell you everything that's really nothing, and nothing of what's everything, of what's crying within me. And so when I'm going through my routine, do not be fooled by what I'm saying. Please listen carefully and try to hear what I am not saying. what I'd like to be able to say for what survival I need to say, but what I can't say. I dislike hiding. Honestly, I do. I dislike the superficial game I'm playing, the superficial phony game. I'd really like to be genuine and spontaneous and me, but you've got to help me. You alone can break down the wall behind which I tremble. You alone can remove my mask. You alone can release me from my shadow world of panic and uncertainty, from my lonely prison. So do not pass me by. Please do not pass me by. It will not be easy for you. A long conviction of worthlessness builds strong walls. The nearer you approach to me, the blinder I may strike back at you. It's irrational, but despite what the books say about man, I am irrational. I fight against the very thing that I cry out for. But I am told that love is stronger than those walls. And in this lies my hope, my only hope. Please try to beat down those walls with firm hands, but with gentle hands, for a child is very sensitive. Who am I, you may wonder? I am someone you know very well, for I'm every man and every woman, every child you meet. I'm the person whose hands you're holding. Open your eyes and look around you and see what a precious person you're holding.